We knew they were there. They've always been there. So when my dad got done working for Eisenhower, probably in 1961, he donated a lot of his papers to the Eisenhower Archives, the museum down there in Abilene, Kansas. And then, but he kept some too. And so we knew they were there. You know, my dad just always wanted to save them. He couldn't bear the thought of getting rid of them. So we just sort of left them there in a corner of the boathouse, and they stayed there for, well, it's been about 50 years. And so we were cleaning out our boathouse this summer. We do that just about every year, and I wasn't going to go. If it were up to me, I would have left them there probably for another 50 years. But my sister, Kathy, said, you know, we got to do something with these. And so she started to go back there and pick out all those boxes. And they were right back there by, you know, it's just like anybody's boathouse. It's filled with old water skis, and we have like a 1957 Evinrude motor back there, and there's a wooden boat that we have from the 30s that's in there. Anyway, she started going through those boxes, and there was a big fat file with the farewell address, and I figured, well, before I go through that, I better contact somebody who really knows the history of this and see if they might be interested. So we got all the boxes out of there. There were about, I think there were a total of 8 boxes that we dug out, and then we consolidated them into 6 boxes and found the Eisenhower Archives online and, you know, sent them down there. They said, sure, we'd be interested, so we sent them down there, but I had no idea that there was anything of value in there.
Wow. Well, it turns out one of the fascinating things about this story that I didn't know, and I think a lot of people didn't know, was your dad worked on that speech for about 9 months before it was given, and of course President Eisenhower and his other advisors worked on it too. But your dad's initial draft started about 8 or 9 months before the actual speech was given, wasn't it?
Yes. The story he always told me is that Eisenhower called him about a year ahead before the speech was to be given and said, you know, when I leave office, I just want to say something really smart. So then they started working on it then. I mean, that's the story my dad told. I don't really know the details about or how important all the drafts were. So when I looked at that, file, I saw there was a lot of, you know, handwritten notes from different people. But I had no idea that there was any sort of interest in the, you know, the different permutations of that speech over time. So I'm just really glad that, you know, we were able to make a great contribution to history. When I was going through the papers, there were a number of, you know, little notes from Eisenhower to my dad, handwritten notes that I came across that, you know, that you would find in any kind of workplace, like, you know, nice job or good to talk with you, and thanks for all of your efforts on this project or that project. And that was pretty cool to see.
Now, one of the main ideas, and perhaps the reason the speech is remembered so well, kind of like John Kennedy's speech, is that phrase about ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country, which Kennedy gave just a few days after Eisenhower's farewell address. One of the most interesting and memorable themes of President Eisenhower's farewell address was that thought about warning the American people about the acquisition of, quote, unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. And we've all had some time to reflect on that over the last 50 years. And what do you think of that?
Well, I think along with everybody else, I think it's a pretty wise counsel, and nobody was in a position to know it better than Eisenhower, you know. And I think my dad believed that true in his heart as well, because just growing up as a kid in the '60s, I was never allowed to play with G.I. Joe or anything like that, but I had a real gun up there at the cabin. I had a real .22. I had, you know, just like most people up there, had shotguns and .22s and things like that, but I was never allowed to have a G.I. Joe, which I always thought was interesting because, I mean, my dad thought it was a kind of glorified war in some way that was not a healthy thing.
Tell us about your dad's journey from growing up in Minnesota and going to the University of Minnesota, what took him to the White House and meeting Eisenhower and becoming a chief speechwriter for him. How did he get there?
Well, he, you know, he did his undergraduate work at the University of Minnesota, and then he got his he got his master's degree and later his PhD, and that took him to a number of teaching assignments. He was at the University of Wyoming for a while. He was at UCLA for a while. And then he took a job as a professor at Johns Hopkins University, which is in Baltimore, Maryland, which is right by D.C. And he also worked for a time as a editorial writer for the Baltimore Sun, also in the Washington, D.C. area. So he was sort of in the proximity, and he had written a book about the history of the Republican Party. And I think that came to the attention of Eisenhower or Eisenhower's brother. And also, my mother she's the only person I know that's really from Washington, D.C. She grew up there and went to school with John Eisenhower. They were in, they went to junior high together, and they were actually in the same class and were friends and knew each other. So I think that probably helped to some degree, but they did know of my dad's work. The Eisenhowers, both Dwight and his brother, knew of his work. So that's kind of where the connection was made.
And after Eisenhower left office and your dad left the White House, there was a debate among people who are interested in American history and in 20th century American history about, did Eisenhower really mean to warn us about the military-industrial complex? Did he feel deeply about this? And did your dad say anything around the house in those years after he left the White House about what Eisenhower thought of the speech?
No, not that I recall, really. No, I don't recall him saying anything like that. But I do think that a lot of people at the time thought Eisenhower was just kind of, not that engaged and kind of a stumbling guy and not that great of a speaker. But, if you look at history and look at Eisenhower and look at, the people that he surrounded himself with, I think Eisenhower had a kind of an uncanny ability to find good, smart people and surround himself with them. And you look at many of the things that he's done over time, and it just he really has to go down as one of the great presidents, certainly in the 20th century, but probably in all of American history.
I'm speaking with Grant Moose. Grant's dad, Malcolm Moose, was president of the University of Minnesota in the 1960s and 70s, and he was also President Eisenhower's chief speechwriter from 1958 to 61. Last fall, Grant and his sister discovered 21 drafts of that famous farewell speech by Eisenhower. It was in the boathouse of their family cabin on Ten Mile Lake near Hackensack. What did your dad say around home about Eisenhower?
Well, he just, he relished his time with Eisenhower. He just thought he was a great guy and a great leader, and they really had a good team. And my dad was friends with the, a lot of the people that worked in the administration, and they'd come to the house every once in a while, and it was a great experience for my dad.
And did you ever have a chance to go to the White House?
Yeah, there is a couple pictures. We went to they have an Easter egg hunt there every year at Easter, and we went to that. And there's a picture of my brother and I. We got to ride on the presidential helicopter at one time, and there's a picture of us on the steps of the helicopter. And when my dad got sworn in as a special assistant, there's a kind of a family photo, so... Yeah, we went there, and the story they tell is that I was born in 55, so I would have been like 3 or 4 or something like that when we went there, I was going to get to, they said, go see the president, and I misinterpreted that. I thought I was going to get a present, like a birthday present or a Christmas present. So I just remember being horribly disappointed when I went there because, all I got to see was a guy, so... That's the family story they tell on me.
Well, now your dad's life and career was at least as full and interesting in the years after he left the White House in 1961. What did he do after that, and how did your family make it back to Minnesota?
Well, he worked for Rockefeller for a while in New York City, and he was doing speech writing for the Rockefeller brothers. And, he'd go around and wherever they wanted him to go, he would go. And he did that for a little bit, and then he took a job at the Ford Foundation, which essentially gives away money. And so he did that till about 66, something like that. And then we came to Minnesota in the fall of 66, and when he accepted the job as president of the University of Minnesota. And, you know, pretty much we've been here ever since.
How many years was he president at the U?
He was president for 7 years until 74. And then he, after that, he went to the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions. It was kind of a think tank in Santa Barbara. He did that for a couple of years, and then he did a couple of some consulting after that for the University of Maryland, and is one of the things that he did.
And then how about the cabin in northern Minnesota near Hackensack? How long has that been in the family?
Well, ever since then, actually. So when the papers, those Eisenhower papers, when we went through them, I found the plans for the cabin and notes from our neighbors up there about, you know, buying the land and all those kinds of things. So that was kind of fun. So that's been, you know, we've kept that in the family now for 50 years, and it's a very important part of our lives, with my brother and my sister, and then all of our kids go up there. My daughter just went up there over the New Year's and sawed a hole in the ice, took a sauna and sawed a hole in the ice and jumped in, you know. So it's really an important part of what we do, and every summer we're up there and the kids come back, and it's like Tara to us.
Yeah, a lot of great memories there, and a lot of things still going on, which is really nice too. Grant, those 7 years he was president of the University of Minnesota, that would be about from 1967 to 74. Those were pretty wild times on American university campuses. What do you remember or know about your dad's years as president of the U?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, it was, you know, a real tumultuous time with the Vietnam War going on. And, you know, I think my dad was credited with, you know, keeping a cool head. You know, I know at the time when there was some real, you know, the student unrest was kind of at its peak. The mayor of Minneapolis wanted to bring cops on campus, and my dad kind of stood him down and said, you can't have any live ammunition on campus. We didn't want to have another Kent State there. And there were deaths on university campuses, you know, and many university campuses aside from Kent State. And so I think, you know, his time there was keeping a cool head and keeping everything as under control as possible. And I think that's what he was probably best remembered for. And he was also, you know, he's very, having spent some time in politics, and my dad's dad was, you know, very involved in politics. And so he understood politics, which you have to do as a university president. And he was very good at raising money, and kind of shameless about asking for, you know, money from people. So he did a lot for the university in that respect, and in getting people to, you know, give money to the university. And we were always involved in that. You know, there'd be a lot of family kinds of things where we'd go and try to help out where we could. Well, you know, I'm, you know, really proud of all the things that he did. You know, he was a Minnesota guy that made it big on the, really on the U.S. and world stage. You know, but he didn't forget his roots. We, you know, all those things that we did about, you know, going up to the cabin and just doing, you know, simple Minnesota things like canoeing and sailing and shooting 22s and shooting trap and things like that. All that stuff was very important to him. And the lake cabin was where he would do a lot of his writing. And he, in fact, we have the main cabin, and then we have a little cabin that was really his, where he would go and get away and do his thinking and things like that. So, you know, I'm just really proud of him.
What was your dad's hometown?
St. Paul. You know, his best friend growing up lived next door to him, Ivor Sickfland, and the Sickflands live right down, you know, they're like less than a mile away out from the lake. And so my dad, that was his connection to 10 Mile. He'd come up there as a kid, as a friend of Ivor's, and right down the shore from us. And then they'd get up there and they'd have a good time up there. And so I'm still friends with Ivor's kids. And my son is friends with Ivor's grandkids. And so, you know, it's all a pretty tight-knit group up there.
How many brothers and sisters do you have?
There's five of us all together. And we all have a bunch of kids, too. So when we get up there, it's quite a mob.